From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the president released a minimal blueprint of his budget priorities, addressing only discretionary spending, about 30% of government outlays. The budgets of the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, and Veterans Affairs go up, and virtually everything else goes down, in some cases way, way down. As for the other 70% of the budget, including Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the national debt, well, we don't know Trump's plans. This is what is known in Washington as a preliminary or skinny budget, but that's putting it lightly.
Usually when an administration comes in, they release this so-called skinny budget, which kind of gives the broad outline of what their fiscal plans are. And then later on, they fill in all the blanks. As one economist I spoke with put it, this skinny budget is emaciated.
Catherine Rampell, columnist for The Washington Post, says that if the budget plan is short on budget plans, it is long on politics.
It's basically a campaign document, near as I can tell. It's about telling the base, see, we are draining the swamp. We're doing everything that we say we're going to do. It's filled with a lot of rhetoric that has this kind of campaign feel to it. Things like, we're putting America first, and other kind of sloganeering. And part of the reason why I don't think this is meant to be taken as a serious document is that it's been heavily criticized, actually, by a lot of Republicans on the Hill. They were not trying to extend an olive branch to Democrats, let alone to their fellow Republicans. This was really just about being able to say, if this doesn't get through, it's not our fault.
But while the language of the document echoes Trump's campaign promises, its details, the few that there are, tell a different story.
Another thing that I'm concerned about is various programs to help the poor. Some of those are safety net programs, whether it's Meals on Wheels or subsidies for low-income people to pay their rent, to pay for energy. There's a big cut coming to before school, after school, and summer programs that a lot of poor working parents rely on and are actually on waiting lists to get into. But then there are other programs that will also affect low-income people that are not exactly what we think of as safety net programs, like the enforcement that the Labor Department does to make sure employers are abiding by minimum wage laws or are not having unsafe work environments or things like that.
We'll be hearing more from Catherine Rampell later in the show. Meanwhile, you'd be forgiven for mistaking this skinny budget for a cruel one, as many have called it after its release. But as budget director Mick Mulvaney explained to CNN's Jim Acosta this week, it's actually quite the opposite.
You were talking about the steel worker in Ohio and the coal miner in Pennsylvania and so on, but those workers may have an elderly mother who depends on the Meals on Wheels program, who may have kids in Head Start. And yesterday or the day before, you described this as a hard power budget, but is it also a hard-hearted budget?
No, I don't think so. I think it's probably one of the most compassionate things we can do to actually tell
you're help the elderly.
You're only
kids?
Focusing on half of the equation, right? You're focusing on recipients of the money. We're trying to focus on both the recipients of the money and the folks who give us the money in the first place. And I think it's fairly compassionate to go to them and say, look, we're not going to ask you for your hard-earned money anymore. Single mom of two in Detroit.
He's talking about all the great tax savings the indigent will enjoy. But poor people don't have big tax bills. They do, however, have a great need for many of the programs now on the chopping block. And as it happens, many of those people are Trump voters. So how does the man who ran on the promise that he alone could make everything better for them rationalize the fact that in his first 100 days in office, his administration seems to be planning to make their lives worse? Curiously, when pressed by Fox's Tucker Carlson on the effects of the Republican health care plan, the president told the truth.
A Bloomberg analysis showed that counties that voted for you, middle class and working class counties, would do far less well under this bill than the counties that voted for Hillary, the more affluent counties.
I know.
It seems like maybe this isn't consistent with the message of the last election.
No, a lot of things aren't consistent, but these are going to be negotiated.
Finally, a recognition of reality. If only the reality weren't so ominous for so many. If only this moment of truth weren't exactly that.
That the president's axe has fallen so harshly on programs for the poor was shocking to some, but not to Jack Freck, who actually works with the poor. For 30 years, he served as welfare director in Appalachian, Ohio, and also as a guide for our recent series, Busted, America's Poverty Myths. To Freck, the proposals put forward by the Trump administration are disheartening. But they're hardly unique. In fact, they are perennial and bipartisan. For example, the Clinton administration bundled what was once federal welfare assistance into block grants to states where the money was shriveled by inflation and often misdirected or hoarded by the states. Now, the Republican Congress is considering block granting Medicaid. Jack, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
As someone who's been working with those in poverty for decades, what do you see that's familiar in the current proposals? You know, the health care bill, the proposed budget, and so on.
Basically, you know, what's happening here is the Republicans do not believe in government in general, and specifically some of these entitlements. They generally don't believe that there is a right to health care. That's why now they talk in terms of people having access to it.
I think people are going to have access to health care and better health care, and they're going to be empowered in their
health care. So people are not going to lose their health insurance because of this?
It will be accessible. They will have the opportunity to have health care, I can assure you.
Well, the truth of the matter is back when we had 40 million people who were uninsured, everyone had the opportunity to buy health care if they could afford it. What's familiar to me going way back is, of course, the same kind of assault on government that I remember vividly during the Reagan administration. Rather than declaring the media as the enemy, he declared government as the enemy.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And he similarly appointed people to cabinet positions who actually opposed the programs that they were now running. Basically, are just taking a whole step back in history to the time when people could have health care if they could afford it. And if you can't, then it was kind of like, that's not government's problem.
Their underlying assumption is that more money will flow into the economy if we tie less of it up in big government and all boats will rise.
This has been the myth that has been promoted by this party all these years. We've already done tax cuts for years and years. Those things have not stimulated the economy here, have not grown living wage jobs. Now, the trouble is, from the Democratic side, their pushback has been what I would call pushback light. I mean, I think the Democrats became so enamored with what they had done with NAFTA, what they had done with welfare reform, all the things that happened under Bill Clinton, all that kind of stuff did not benefit us in the long run. And the hubris of the party will not allow them to accept that their basic tenets of their philosophy have not worked. And that's true from both parties.
You say that the Democrats are so loath to admit they were wrong about NAFTA and about block granting aid to the poor to the states and those things that they're sort of hoist on their own petard. I wonder, though, when the Republicans talk against big government, talk about reducing the role of government. Can't the Democrats offer some big pushback there?
Well, they could. But Barack Obama, throughout his whole term in office, all they ever reported on was the increase in private sector jobs. They almost never ever even talked about public sector jobs and the fact that there were more public sector jobs lost during the Obama administration than any of the previous administrations, even under Reagan. And then the fact that the biggest cut in food stamps happened at the direction of the Obama administration, not at the direction of the Republicans. And the other thing to remember is the Obamacare program itself was, in fact, a private sector intervention in healthcare originally proposed by the Heritage Foundation. It basically forced everyone to buy insurance through the private sector. And, you know, once they dropped the public option, it was entirely privatized. And then problems that all cropped up with this, with increased premiums, with increased deductibles, with increased costs, and with lack of access. people in the private sector running those businesses made those choices, and it essentially then was used to hang the Obamacare program.
So you're saying that since the Democratic administration and other Democratic administrations have done things that have reduced the role of government, they're poor advocates for the power of government to do good.
Yes, in order for them to do so, and they should do so, the first thing they have to do is admit they were wrong. I mean, everyone talks about how hard it is for Donald Trump to ever admit he's wrong about anything. Well, you know, I don't think that Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi or Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama are any better at saying these are the things that we did that were wrong. And what you will hear is when these debates start happening, the Republicans are going to say, but you already agreed to this concept for welfare reform. We worked together on those things. So now we're telling you that we're just trying to do those same things and offer that same success for the Medicaid program.
In fact, on the news the other day, former Republican presidential candidate and Republican Congressman Rick Santorum was sharing a platform with Gene Sperling, who was an economist in the Clinton administration.
And Santorum was the one who said, but Gene, don't you remember when you and I worked together to have this great success with welfare reform?
I believe that their answer here is for Republicans to take a step back and do what Gene Sperling and I did together back in the 1990s. Gene and I worked on a bill called welfare reform. And what Gene and Bill Clinton and a lot of other Republicans and Democrats did was to take this money, give it back to the states, let the states innovate.
And threw it back to Sperling, who was just dumbstruck and basically said, well, that was different.
And I appreciate Senator Santorum mentioning moments we were bipartisan, but I don't agree with him in this case. In terms of Medicaid.
But what Sperling did not say is, yes, we worked together on all those things and they were a disaster. This was terrible for poor people. Their lives are infinitely worse off now than they were before that. That's what he needed to say. He never said that. There has never been a time when anyone other than Bernie in the Democratic Party has really stepped up and said, no, this was a failure. This was not a success. It was a terrible failure.
You've described the failures of both political parties and also of the media. So let's dig into that. What's the problem here? Is it that reporters just haven't done their homework, or is there something else going on?
I don't think they've done their homework. There may be a bigger question as to why they haven't done their homework. The easiest way for them to structure a debate is to have a Republican on and have a Democrat on and say, okay, go at it. I don't think that folks in the media have been able to take the time and homework they need to do to actually be the arbitrators of the truth and to call people on both sides and say, these are the facts that we know about this issue. And of course, there is not the same kind of local reporting, investigative reporting going on about these issues to build up to a more national understanding about it.
One of the chief narratives that emerged after the election was that the mainstream media had lost touch with the lived reality of many people.
Yes.
Seen any improvement in the media coverage since?
I have. I have seen better coverage, sending real people out to Kentucky and West Virginia and Ohio and places like that, and talking to people. Mostly the angle they're looking at is, do you realize you're voting against your own best interest? I mean, mm-hmm. That seems to be what they're looking for out there, and they're finding people who are hurting. At least they're getting out there and they're talking to them.
And they don't feel they're voting against their economic self-interest?
I don't think they believe that yet. These folks are hardworking people, and what they want are the living wage jobs that they used to have. Donald Trump is the guy who stepped up and said, I'm going to give those back to you. They were so desperate, and people did not understand how desperate they were, that they basically said, okay, you know, we will give you a chance. And the other thing to keep in mind about that is that people who struggle every day just to survive do not spend their time on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, waiting for the latest comment or goofy thing that Donald Trump's going to say and the mounds of response that come from the media. They're not going to be able to look at the nuance of the different Medicaid program versus block grant versus entitlement. Not that they're not smart enough. They just don't have the time. Their lives are consumed by paying the rent, keeping their car running, getting to work all different hours of the day or night, And so they're still waiting for the promise made to them about their lives getting better, about them still having health care like he promised, about them having living wage jobs like he promised, all the great things he promised. They're still waiting for those things to happen.
I hear you when you say these people are too busy to be having rich and varied media diets that can provide them with all kinds of information. But I wonder, do they have any at all, or simply they heard him on the campaign trail? He's never really left the campaign trail, and the information that comes out just isn't getting through.
Well, this goes back to the core issue about Trump in the first place. They were desperate enough to reach out to vote for this guy with just pie in the sky promises because their lives were so desperate to begin with. And so it's not as though hoping that he succeeds is, you know, a political thing for them, an ideological thing. This is their hope at survival.
Okay, so journalists are trying to suss out people whose experience is so often different from their own. How do you recommend they do that?
My greatest wish for journalism has been just that they go out and report the real facts for what people's lives are like out there. Instead of looking at this from a standpoint of politics, they need to be looking at this as what is the status of people in our country? What are their lives like? What are their issues? And then you follow from that to the parties to say, are either of these parties addressing the issues that we find when we go out and talk to Americans? You don't need to go very far to do that. You need to go out with just an open mind and talk to them in a non-judgmental way. I think a lot of folks, even out in the field, when they're out there talking to the right people, their whole thing is, why did you vote wrong? Why did you make the mistake of voting for Donald Trump? Well, you know, you need to approach it much more from the standpoint of why was that the right decision for you in your mind? And the other thing is that these folks, they're very fatalistic and don't feel like they have the power to control this. The last lever they thought they pulled to fix this was the one where they voted for Donald Trump.
Okay, Jack. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jack Freck is a former welfare director in Athens County, Ohio. To hear him in all 5 episodes of our series, Busted, go to onthemedia.org/poverty.
Coming up, arguments over numbers, who supplies them, and whether we have to believe them if we don't feel like it.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Since the early days of his campaign, Trump has thrived on his image as a dealmaker who will supercharge the American economy. Now that it's time for the Trump White House to demonstrate how it's going to pull it off, it's using economic forecasts to bolster its claims. Reportedly, the White House predicts GDP growth as high as 3 to 3.5%, higher growth than it's seen in over a decade. And Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin stood by that number in an interview in February.
I think it's very achievable. We believe that we can be competitive and get back to sustainable growth of 3% or more.
But Thursday's release of the White House budget plan contained no details about projected economic growth.
It is incredibly unusual. Every administration, going back to at least Reagan, has, in this version of the budget, included economic forecasts.
Catherine Rampell, columnist at The Washington Post, says it's not unusual for politicians to make generous projections of economic growth under their policies.
My general rule of thumb is that the more growth a politician promises, probably the worse their economic plan is. It's a little counterintuitive, but the reason why that more or less holds true is that they use these forecasts to help guide what they think is reasonable to ask for from Congress and also to project to the world what they think their policy agenda will actually achieve. Reagan was known for having a sort of imaginary cabinet member named Rosie Scenario, as you may recall. Rosie's scenario did not materialize, sadly. Her numbers were too strong.
But you do note that what the Trump administration is doing here is extraordinary. if the Trump administration is projecting between 3 and 3.5% growth as a result of the implementation of his policies, how did he arrive at that number?
That's an excellent question. Normally, the way that this process works is that career staffers at the Council of Economic Advisers put together a forecast with input from people from Treasury, from the Office of Management and Budget, other people throughout the government. They've put together a model. They figure out, okay, what are our assumptions for labor force participation or productivity or inflation? And then they plug in all these numbers and then they spit out whatever their economic growth estimate is. This time, they did the reverse. During the transition for Trump, members of the transition team worked with the career staffers and said, you guys just have to figure out what to plug into your model to come up with this result. Produce estimates that show 3 to 3.5% growth, and then backfill everything else to get it to add up, which is unheard of. Unheard of.
How much latitude do the career professionals at the Council of Economic Advisers have in carrying out this instruction to reverse engineer the result?
My sources said that they complained a lot because they didn't view the results as likely to be credible, because normally that is something that a White House cares about. But if they're way far off from what everybody else says, then people will laugh and say, why should we trust you? So the career staffers want to do work that they think is grounded in evidence, credible to the outside world. But ultimately, they don't get to decide. It's the political appointees, in this case, transition officials, and now other economic advisors within the White House, not who would normally be the direct bosses of the CEA.
Setting aside, as you wrote in your column, the sheer intellectual dishonesty of this approach, there are long-term consequences. Describe them.
The issue is that these numbers greatly overestimate what the economy will do and therefore will be used to justify tremendous tax cuts as well as spending increases. Trump has proposed a historically large increase in the defense budget. If you assume that economic growth will be way faster than anybody else believes, then that means fewer people will be poor. Fewer people will be middle income, for that matter. They won't need help paying for health insurance, amongst other household necessities, because, hey, we're all going to be rich. That's basically the bottom line of this forecast. They are assuming away any problems for American families.
But is it even feasible?
No, it's not feasible. Even, for example, Glenn Hubbard, who was an economic advisor to Mitt Romney, to George W. Bush, he has said that sustained growth above 2.75% is not in any way realistic. And most economists I've talked with say that that number, that upper bound that Glenn Hubbard gave, is kind of ludicrous as well.
As you've noted, not only are the economic growth rates he's boasting astronomically high, they're in conflict with the projections of other federal agencies. Given all of that, can we still expect Congress to buy it?
Well, typically we have sources of accountability that all parties have agreed on are more or less truthful, useful for providing us with data on how our policies are working out and what would happen if we took one option versus another. Those are things like the Congressional Budget Office, which does forecasting and estimates for how much bills will cost, as well as how they might affect the economy. And the unemployment rate comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Mm-hmm.
The BLS also produces the inflation numbers and mm-hmm. a lot of other very important metrics for determining the health of the U.S. economy. And there are a number of other statistical agencies like the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, that similarly gather and distill data. But now, these very important institutions that serve both as a status update and a check on how well our politicians are doing have been discredited because sometimes they produce numbers that are inconvenient. So there are guardrails in place, procedural, regulatory barriers to prevent tampering with the data. One reason those have been put in place is that Richard Nixon tried to tamper with the data.
Isn't there one way you can push the whole thing over the guardrail, which is simply starve those agencies of funds, not replace the professionals who leave through attrition or otherwise? Because we've seen with the EPA and other kinds of statistics, the Congress or the White House simply says, we're not going to fund that kind of research anymore.
Absolutely. I'm very concerned about gutting of statistical agencies because that kind of flies under the radar. And if the White House wanted to sabotage statistical collection, that is the way that they would do it. And frankly, that's the way Congress has been doing it for the last several years. When I have spoken with alumni of these various statistical agencies, including past Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioners, they're not worried about somebody coming in and moving a decimal point somewhere in the unemployment report. What they're worried about is funding cuts. Funding cuts could have really bad effects for the robustness of the data. You need a minimum number of survey respondents in order for the numbers to, like, really mean anything, for there not to be an enormous margin of error, for example. So if you cut their funding, ultimately they'll either have to get rid of some of these data points that they produce entirely, and they have. Like the Bureau of Economic Analysis has gotten rid of some data series that have to do with outsourcing because, hey, who cares about outsourcing? It's not like that's a hot topic right now.
Wow.
But their budget has been cut. So they have to choose between what kinds of reports and what kinds of data they can collect.
What are the consequences if, say, for example, a budget passed based on a 3.5% growth rate?
There are a few likely outcomes. You get much more expensive policies than you would otherwise because you can kind of paper over the cost with this growth. Do people care about growth rates? I don't know. You know, it's not exactly a kitchen table issue probably. But what I will say, if Rosie's scenario does not materialize, you will see further attempts to discredit the institutions that produce the inconvenient data. Because Trump is going to say, oh, the Bureau of Economic Analysis says that growth is only 1%. I believe it's 6%. They're all liars, and therefore we should defund them further. That's one scenario I can very easily see playing out.
Catherine, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Catherine Rampell is a columnist for The Washington Post. This week also brought the return of an increasingly familiar Washington ritual, the bickering over the probity of the Congressional Budget Office.
The Congressional Budget Office releases projected costs of the GOP's health care bill, while the White House and Republicans question the agency's analysis.
If you're looking to the CBO for accuracy, you're looking in the wrong place.
Well, whatever one's opinion about the CBO, there's no doubt that this scoring of yesterday will change the debate. More than one senator has already said that the bill is dead upon arrival in the Senate.
The CBO score, which assesses a bill's fiscal impact, is so central that House Speaker Paul Ryan, the driver behind the new Obamacare replacement bill, sought to preempt it last week on CBS's Face the Nation.
The one thing I'm certain will happen is CBO will say, well, gosh, not as many people will get coverage. You know why? Because this isn't a government mandate.
So true. The CBO estimates that 24 million people will lose coverage over the next 10 years under Ryan's plan. But all this CBO bashing follows a script that often is flipped. Sometimes it's Republicans who extol the agency as a paragon of nonpartisan virtue, and Democrats who challenge its worth, as in 2009.
The shocker of the week in the healthcare debate, the Independent Congressional Budget Office saying the Democrats' bill will cut Medicare benefits. Democratic leaders deny it, of course.
But it wasn't always like this, says Zachary Carabel. He's the author of The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World. He says that though CBO was created in 1974, it wasn't until the deficit panics a decade later that it took on its current role.
The Congressional Budget Office would assess all future legislation for its effects on future government deficits. The idea that, left to its own devices, Congress will spend a lot of money. Because, look, nobody gets elected because they promise to take stuff away. They get elected because they promise to bring government money in.
It forces legislators to be accountable because they've been warned by the CBO.
Correct.
So every bill is looked at as a potential deficit builder or deficit reducer.
Correct.
And this bill, healthcare, you suggest seems to have been designed less as an insurance bill and more as a deficit reducer.
Correct. More consequential for the CBO was this potential law will reduce deficits by $300+ billion over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It also said, look, we're going to reduce the number of people insured by 20 to 24 million people. Those formulas were only applied to the number of uninsured insofar as they affect how much the government may or may not be on the hook for, how much Medicaid or how much Medicare spending there will have to be, which is a government outlay.
Now let's talk about the two big problems that you identify with this reliance on the CBO, one of which it's often wrong. The other, the role it plays in Congress to shape policy. You say it limits the imagination.
Right. So let's do the first one first, which is it's often wrong. It could not be anything other than often wrong, given the constraints under which it operates. Things like the Federal Reserve are constantly in the business of revising and revising and revising and reflecting based on a constantly changing world. The Congressional Budget Office is set up to assess at the point of potential passage what's the effect. You can factor in what the costs are at the time it's passed. You cannot, or at least they do not, factor in potential savings from the spending. So if I spend $100 million to build a bridge, all that you can factor in for sure is that you've spent $100 million. You can argue that it will save commuting time, that will lead to less gas, that trucks will use, all these virtuous effects. But it would require the CBO to do much more complicated multi-factor probabilities. And that doesn't work so well in Capitol Hill, where you'd get people going, I like that probability, and someone else going, well, I like that one.
Scenarios, the very thing that might broaden the imagination and the possibilities, would just become partisan brickbats.
People would pick their probability. We existed for 200 years without a Congressional Budget Office, and bills were passed, money was spent, and the arguments were usually, does this serve the public good? Sometimes the arguments were, does it serve my constituents? It wasn't always noble. It was sometimes venal. But it was almost always in the context of, is there a goal here that this bill leads to?
So give me some examples of bills that you think would not have gotten a good CBO score.
The passage of the Interstate Highway Act under the Eisenhower administration, which people look at as one of the great 20th century federal acts of national infrastructure spending.
These new highways will have a far-reaching economic impact on the entire nation. They provide a heavy-duty link between all parts of productive America.
To be fair, if there had been a Congressional Budget Office, they never would have factored in the environmental effects of it because of all the things that I said, even though a more broad probabilistic lens would have said, what would the environmental impact of this be? So you could argue that kind of law would have had a tough go of it.
You think that the GI Bill would have gotten a bad score?
Oh, unquestionably, you know, because what's the return?
I mean, you could certainly calculate people with better educations being more productive.
That will lead to people having better paying jobs, which will lead to more tax collection, which will lead to more revenue for the government, which will more than pay for itself.
You really think it would have scored badly?
Because you wouldn't have been able to score those things. Look, my essential critique of this, as you've indicated, is that by trying to squeeze everything into simple binary formulas, we throw a lot of babies out with the bathwater. There may be a lot of really negative, pork, unnecessary spending that we avoid, but it is clear that we probably also avoid a lot of necessary spending, particularly in the short term.
So last week, the White House hailed the Department of Labor's latest jobs report. It's the same figures that President Trump used to call phony.
Yeah, I talked to the president prior to this, and he said, to quote him very clearly, they may have been phony in the past, but it's very real now.
You've written that these indicators were never meant to be part of the national conversation to begin with.
So look, these numbers basically got invented during the Great Depression. So we've had these numbers for a little less than 90 years.
One of FDR's economists, Simon Kuznets, he was pretty concerned that these numbers would be misused.
Absolutely. I mean, Kuznets is often credited legitimately as the father of GDP. I mean, he really created what we now know as measuring a nation's economic activity. He thought this was incredibly important just to understand these systems. But he was very concerned that numbers and statistics are always stories. They tell you what they tell you, but they don't tell you what they don't tell you. They're limited. And so Kuznets, later in life, he became the classic, you know, little like Oppenheimer with the bomb, right? Be careful what you've created.
The destroyer of worlds?
He was a destroyer of statistical worlds. But he was very concerned, particularly as the 1930s evolved and things like national income became part of the discussion and part of the way that the Roosevelt administration was trying to say to the public, look, the New Deal is working. I can prove that it's working because our national income is going up.
Farmers are no longer in deep distress and have greater purchasing power. Dangers of security speculation have been minimized. National income is almost 50% higher than it was in 1932. And government has an established and accepted responsibility for relief.
In spite of Kuznets' reservations about these numbers being misused for political gain, those numbers were indeed misused for political gain and have been ever since.
Now, there is an implied argument in your writing against having an organization like the CBO issuing scores and so on. But you need some data, and I know there are plenty of places that produce it. Are you saying we don't particularly need this data?
I'm a little bit like Kuznets in this. The danger of good but limited information.
But that's all we have. We never have the possibility of getting unlimited information.
No, but you can aspire to a political dialogue about crucial public issues that recognizes that there is some combination of certainty and uncertainty. What are the public outcomes we're trying to achieve? And yes, what are the economic consequences of that? But that is not the sole basis on which to justify these things. We don't justify national defense based on its budget contribution. We justify national defense based on, do we believe this will make us safer? And is the world that we're shaping by virtue of spending that the world we want to live in? So I am in no way saying we shouldn't think about these things. I am saying we have all the tools at our disposal to do this much more sophisticated analysis of what's a probable set of outcomes. We could create our statistical agencies and demand of them those variety of outcomes, but that would demand our politicians act like adults. And when I say like adults, I mean are willing to sit with certainty and uncertainty in the service of good public outcomes.
And to share that uncertainty with their constituents.
Correct.
Clearly, deficit reduction has been much more an obsession for the Republicans in recent years than Democrats. So when you question the CBO, is that partly because its focus on deficit reduction is such a conservative enterprise?
I think it's small c conservative. I don't think you need to be like a big government proponent to question the straitjacket that the CBO can create. Having really good analysis of possible outcomes, that is vital.
But no score.
Not a score is the end all and be all of it. Because again, there are times when you can spend money to save money. Spending money can serve the public good. That has become a liberal, I suppose, perspective, but it is not inherently a liberal perspective. And doing that with discipline, you know, may be a conservative perspective. And there's huge virtue in both. I don't think the CBO, as it is currently constituted, allows for that mixture of art and science.
Zachary, thank you very much.
Thank you for the discussion.
Zachary Karabel is author of The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World, and is head of global strategies at Investnet.
Coming up, the truth behind the latest WikiLeaks document dump. Hint, your TV hasn't been taken over by the CIA.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, WikiLeaks released a gigantic cache of documents about how the CIA does its job. And yes, it was everyone's big story.
Explosive new documents revealed by WikiLeaks.
Can the CIA spy on us using the technology we touch every day?
They say the agency is spying on people via their computers, their smartphones, and even their TVs.
Trouble is, says computer security expert Nicholas Weaver, the media portrayed the material in the data dump as new, incendiary, and very spooky, when in fact it was essentially a how-to guide for CIA operations that mostly are already known and don't affect American citizens. But Weaver says the exaggerated fear-mongering coverage was precisely what WikiLeaks sought to engineer by doing its own analysis of the documents and serving that up to reporters.
Here's an example. The WikiLeaks analysis pointed to the CIA phone hacking as how the CIA breaks Signal. Signal is an encrypted messenger that can keep your messages safe from everybody. How many CIA breaks Signal stories did you see?
The CIA had managed to crack the encryption used in very popular applications like WhatsApp or Signal.
The CIA hacks into their smartphones, even into encrypted apps like Signal and WhatsApp.
Now, WikiLeaks says the CIA and British intelligence are capable of bypassing the security in those kinds of apps.
This is deliberately deceptive, that if I can take over your phone, I can read the messages you send. There was nothing in the documents about CIA actually breaking Signal. It's just the well-known fact that if somebody compromises your cell phone, you see the encryption. It's like saying, I broke Signal because I'm watching you type in your message.
Another example, the CIA can hack your car. Here's what WikiLeaks wrote.
As of October 2014, the CIA was also looking at infecting the vehicle control systems used by modern cars and trucks. The purpose of such control is not specified, but it would permit the CIA to engage in nearly undetectable assassinations.
And here's the coverage.
Another document reveals a program the CIA was working on to hack into cars, either to listen in or even crash them for assassinations.
And the actual document is basically, oh, people are doing car hacking. This is interesting.
Perhaps the scariest misleading narrative seeded by WikiLeaks, that the CIA can spy on you through your TV.
Your own home under government surveillance? How the CIA may be using everyday devices like your TV to spy on you.
In order to do this, the CIA has to walk up to your television, plug something in the back, and manipulate the remote. If the CIA can do that, they can just stick a bug under the table.
There is no evidence that any of these tools were deployed against Americans or that we are particularly at risk, from the CIA anyway, of being surveilled through the Internet of Things.
Correct. There's no evidence of any abuse. Even for foreigners, this is reassuring because there's nothing in here that indicates mass surveillance. 99.999%+ of the world doesn't actually need to worry about the CIA. And the fraction that do, we want them to worry about the CIA.
And that's another point. It's like we're shocked that there's espionage going on at the CIA. Well, yeah, they're a spy organization. So the breathlessness of the reporting in and of itself seems odd.
And I think WikiLeaks helped that by creating this sense of pressure. They provided 500 megabytes of stuff that consisted mostly of internal developer notes and stuff like that. When they released everything at once, they effectively overwhelmed the press and created a land rush mentality that forced reporters in a hurry to go with WikiLeaks' analysis. To quote from WikiLeaks' own release, has WikiLeaks already mined all the best stories? No, WikiLeaks has intentionally not written up hundreds of impactful stories to encourage others to find them and so create expertise in the area for subsequent parts in this series. They're there. Look. Won't other journalists find all the best stories before me? Unlikely. There are considerably more stories than there are journalists or academics who are in a position to write them. They deliberately created this rush mentality that results in bad reporting.
There was also a quid pro quo. WikiLeaks said those who acted quickly, which is to say, jumped at the analysis provided by WikiLeaks, would be rewarded later with early releases of subsequent data dumps. So, you know, kind of like, I'll bribe you not to do your job right?
That seems like such a cynical, accurate view.
What's a bit odd about this story, Nick, is that typically when there's massive document dumps, often by a government agency under some sort of PR pressure, the intention is to obscure the contents to create a haystack from which it is very difficult to locate a needle. In this case, if I understand you correctly, WikiLeaks dumped this material, said, yes, it's a haystack, but allow us to helpfully call your attention to the needles buried within.
Correct.
And the needles that they pointed to didn't really amount to much.
Because in order to evaluate the needles, you needed expertise. So you had good reporting by reporters who knew who to call. So, for example, Ellen Nakashima of The Washington Post did it right. She had a broad contact list of people, and she kept recontacting people like me throughout the day as the story evolved to go, is this part of the story real? Is this realistic? Is this not? And as a consequence, her reporting was fantastic. The New York Times did fix their coverage. So they initially tweeted out with a CIA break signal lead, and they actually deleted their tweet and changed their article in response to comments from the technical experts. So some people did get it right.
But others did exactly what you say WikiLeaks intended for them to do, which is to rush to some pretty explosive conclusions based on the signposts set up by WikiLeaks. Why? What's in it for WikiLeaks to do this?
WikiLeaks has a recent history of being very anti-US. So they've previously published CIA tasking orders purported to target the French election in 2012. It's the CIA's job to know what's happening in an election of the French government. And they try to make up this big scandal. Beyond the disruption to the U.S., I don't know what their motives are, and you'd have to ask the guy running WikiLeaks who's hiding from sexual assault charges.
WikiLeaks said in a press release that the document dump was about initiating public debate.
This is not about public debate. If you wanted to talk about public debate, focus on the Snowden leaks. Those revealed programs that significantly disrupted people across the world. This reveals stuff that's basically the kind of thing I would assign to advanced undergrads in computer security. Build malcode that does this. Build a device that copies floppies. This is reasonable intrusion 101.
But is there anything that was dumped that in the hands of, you know, good undergraduate programmers could be used for mischief?
Fortunately, no. Unlike most other releases, they actually did a reasonable job retracting things, and they did not include tools at all. Now, the tools that they seem to have that they redacted are really simple things. They aren't cyber weapons, but they didn't even release those.
The corrections of the story don't help very much, because once the notion of the CIA snooping on you through your thermostat or whatever gets into the ether, I don't think it's ever leaving. How will we know how much damage has been done here?
It's impossible to know, but that is the damage done. They lost effectively no technical capabilities, but they got totally hammered in the court of world opinion. And so this was an attack in many ways on the CIA, and it worked.
And the moral of this story and your advice for reporters dealing with WikiLeaks in the future?
Step back and wait an hour. There's many of us in the security field who now know WikiLeaks' game plan, and we will be analyzing this stuff in real time on Twitter, and reporters are welcome to join in. The real disappointing thing is that this happened before with the Podesta emails, that there was very little, when you actually talk to political scientists, that was revelatory in all those emails. But there were so many stories.
Well, there was a great recipe, if I recall correctly.
Yes, but everybody knows you have to be patient stirring risotto.
Nick, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nicholas Weaver is a senior staff researcher focusing on computer security at the International Computer Science Institute at Berkeley.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Michael Loewinger. We had more help from Sara Kari, Leia Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Terrence Bernardo and Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.